Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is going on in the White House with the exit of the Chief of Staff as they gear up for a tough re-election campaign. And as results from the New Hampshire primary vote come in, the polls have just closed, we will speak with Mike Lux, the founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, and discuss what seems to be shaping up as an Obama-Romney race this year. Then we'll be joined by Sarah Posner, the senior editor of Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. She has an article about Rick Santorum at Religion Dispatches, the GOP's race to the dark ages. And we will discuss the desperate scramble on the part of the religious right power brokers to find a suitable anti-Romney candidate. Then finally, we'll speak with the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies, Michael Clare. As the possibility of a new war breaking out in the Gulf escalates, we will discuss his latest article, Danger Waters, the three top hotspots of potential conflict in the geo-energy age. Joining us now is Mike Lux, a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and is the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. He has an article at the Huffington Post, So Much for a Quiet Monday Afternoon, and another at the Daily Kos, Why Elections Matter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thanks for having me on.
And at this point, of course, the results are just coming in, 36% for Romney, 25% for Paul, 17% for Huntsman, 11% for Gingrich. I think that's with 11%. Santorum gets 10% and Perry gets 1%. I guess it's not much of a stretch to imagine an Obama-Romney race.
No, I think that's where we're headed. You know, I think there are two important stories coming out of New Hampshire, as far as we can tell from the early results. One is that Santorum was not able to consolidate the conservative vote, and I think if he had been able to come out of Iowa and sort of push Gingrich out of the way and kind of lessen Paul's appeal among some libertarian conservatives and consolidate more of that conservative vote, I think he could have been a strong challenger to Romney all throughout the rest of the race, because let's face it, most of the Republican electorate is not crazy about Mitt Romney, but he hasn't been able to do that. I think there's going to be South Carolina, you know, will once again see a split of the conservative vote, we may well see Romney win South Carolina. If that happens, then it really is done, I think. The other interesting story to me, though, is that Huntsman may have done himself enough good. We'll have to see what happens at the end of the results. But if Huntsman ends up doing as well as finishing second or tied for second, close to second with Ron Paul, he may emerge as someone who draws enough votes away from Romney in future, future states that it might give a Gingrich or a Santorum a chance to stay around longer. I don't see anybody beating Romney, you know, for the nomination, because he's just got too much money and too much organization all along the way. But the Huntsman emerging as an alternative would draw some votes away from him, away from Romney, which might make things a little more interesting down the road.
Well, Mike Lux, it seems, though, that the Republicans are being fairly pragmatic in their vote. Nobody's particularly excited about Romney, but the assumption is that he's getting this kind of support that he's getting because people want somebody to beat Obama, and that seems to be the one unifying fact amongst the Republicans. And given the split amongst the religious right vote, particularly where the spear carriers are Romney and Gingrich and Santorum, both of whom are Catholic fundamentalists, Perry was their hope. He fizzled. I'm wondering whether we're exaggerating that. I mean, it's true, and it's ironic that the Republican establishment, while assiduously rewarding the billionaires and millionaires in a slavish way, nevertheless have encouraged for decades these value voters. But at this election is going to be bad economics, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. The dominant thing that people are worried about, including the so-called value voters, the religious right voters, is economics right now. I mean, we've just gone through too rough a period for everyone, for economy not to be the number one thing on people's mind, and I think it does make it harder for a candidate like Santorum, who's running around talking about abortion and being against gay rights more than he's talking about the economy, although he does talk about the economy as well, in fairness. But when he's leading with those issues, I think it makes it harder for him. It's just not a year where you can lead with those kinds of issues and have a chance, even in a Republican primary like that, which is as conservative as a block of voters as can be.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Lux, a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995 and has an article at the Huffington Post, So Much for a Quiet Monday Afternoon, and another at the Daily Kos, Why Elections Matter. So, what's going on at the White House then, Mike, with the exit of the chief of staff at the very moment when they should be gearing up, and presumably they are, for a very tough re-election battle? It seems to me that one of the most frightening statistics for Democrats is the extent to which the Republicans are gaining traction with blue-collar voters. And this has always been a fact of life, hasn't it been, that the way Republicans become a majority party is by peeling off Democratic votes. There's just not that many millionaires and billionaires out there.
Right.
And they do it very, very skillfully with the Reagan Democrats, et cetera.
Well, yeah, they've been doing it since the era of Nixon by appealing to their own version, frankly, of class warfare. I find it funny that they attack the Democrats for that when they practice it far more than our candidates do, and which is to the detriment of our candidates, in my view. So I think that the basic dynamic at the White House is, you know, when Bill Daley came in, the operative assumption was that, okay, the Republicans took control of Congress, or at least the House. We're going to have to deal with them. We're going to have to deal more with the business community because they're going to have more clout, and that the way to win re-election is to move to the center, whatever that means. But I think Washington people tend to think moving to the center means being more pro-business. I don't happen to actually think that. To me, the center vote, and the reason that Republicans do well sometimes is that blue collar, more populist vote, and they don't care at all about Democrats cuddling up to corporate America. But they also don't trust government, and that's why they're swing voters. They're swing voters because they don't trust government and because they don't trust corporate America. And so Washington's version of centrism doesn't work with those voters, and that's the mistake I think Democrats have made over many years.
But isn't this president?
Well, I was just going to say that was the operative assumption that the Obama people were making when Daley came in. A year later, they have come to accept, you know, what folks like me have been arguing for a long time, which is that you have to be more populist. You have to be you have to appeal to the Democratic base and excite them, but you also have to appeal to working class voters. And the way you do that is by being economic populist. Bill Daley was never going to be comfortable with that strategy, but that's the strategy that everybody else in the Obama White House is heading. So I haven't been the least bit surprised that he wanted to get out of there.
Well, that may have something to do with the Occupy movement, right? I mean, it's out there in the zeitgeist that there is this very, very powerfully framed reality of the 99% versus the 1%. And if you ever had a candidate that represents the 1%, Mitt Romney is tailor-made. I'm just astounded that this White House has been so corporate friendly. And been so late. I mean, first of all, they never went after Wall Street at the moment that they came in when they inherited this disaster. And believe it or not, it was the Tea Party who picked up on the outrage over what happened on Wall Street, which, you know, the left just left for them to grab.
Yeah, well, I think progressives did try to grab it, but. The Obama people completely butchered the politics of it, as well as the policy of it. I mean, they were way too Wall Street friendly in their policies, and that's what hurt them with voters. I think that is starting to change as the politics of it changed. But I'll give you one statistic from the 2010 election, which I think tells the ultimate story on this. That is that when asked who was to blame for the economy, you know, about a quarter of people said Bush, about a quarter of people said Obama, almost 40% said Wall Street. But of that 40%, Republicans beat the Democrats in the 2010 elections 56-42. Now you can't win an election. If you're losing the people who say that Wall Street's to blame for the economy, if you're a Democrat, you can't win the election if the people who say Wall Street's to blame are voting against you. But their perception was that Obama was a Wall Street guy, and that was one of the reasons they voted against him.
Well, isn't the most alarming statistic there, Mike Lux, is that in 2008, about 140 million Americans voted and swept the Democrats in. They got the trifecta, the White House, the Senate, and the House, which they hadn't had since Clinton came in 92. And 2 years later, they got creamed because only 75 million people voted, almost half of the number. So how do you, you know, obviously the challenge for this White House is to inspire the half of the electorate who didn't show up in 2010.
Yeah, you know, I think, but you have to remember that 2010 being an off year.
I understand election, the mathematics of off.
There are less people who come out to vote, but I did think it was very significant that, for example, African Americans and young people who were the two constituencies who were most inspired by Obama in the 2008 election. Both of those dropped off dramatically in the vote in 2010. They were no longer inspired, and that was a very big deal for Democrats. That, you know, if our base voters, the voters who are most excited about us, don't turn out, we're dead. We cannot win this election without those groups turning out, and it's very hard to turn them out in a tough economy. I mean, I was knocking on doors in some tough neighborhoods, 2010. Friends of mine were, staff of mine were, and we were finding people who were saying, you know, I'm just too focused on trying to get a job to worry about politics right now. I haven't been thinking about the election. I don't want to. I just need to get a job. When you got a tough economy, it's Democratic base voters who usually are the most affected by it who are not going to turn out to vote.
So with Romney now at well, he's around 35%, Ron Paul at 24%, Huntsman at 18%, Gingrich at 11%, Santorum at 10%, Perry at 1%. It makes you wonder what the hell Perry's doing in there. Do you think he's made some deal with with Romney to just be a spoiler in South Carolina? I mean, even Romney is not craven enough to put that buffoon on in the cabinet, is he?
Well, you know, he might be. I think Romney's craven enough to do anything, honestly. I mean, he enjoys firing people, after all.
Well, he was referring, to be fair to him, he was referring to firing vendors and companies that don't provide good services.
Yeah, I know. I'm kidding. But I wouldn't put such a deal past him. I think Perry's theory, in fairness to Perry, is he didn't even campaign in New Hampshire. His theory is he's going to go to South Carolina and try to win there and revive his campaign. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, my understanding, though, Mike Lux, from people that I've spoken to at Harvard who put on these seminars, they still do it. They go for a weekend where they get the head of the religious right, rubbing shoulders with the head of a big union. And that Barack Obama, when he was at Harvard, just loved to go to these things, and he really is a genuine centrist in the sense that he wants to be bipartisan, and look where that's got him. Has he really learned the lesson? Because I know when he came in, Pelosi and others tried to tell him he was wasting his time, but they spent so much of their time reaching out to the Republicans and. They've got nothing but abuse and really insult. I think I think there's a genuine disdain for that they have towards Obama that borders on kind of racism. It's very disturbing.
Yeah, I think you're right about all that. I do think that the Obama folks seem to have learned their lesson to some extent, at least. I think that trying to be bipartisan is always going to be Obama's first instinct. If he gets reelected, he may go back to that some. But I do think that this last year taught him and the team something about just how far the Republicans have gone off the deep end in terms of being willing to work. Like I said with Daley, when they brought Daley in, they thought Daley was going to be the guy who could cut these deals with Republicans in the business community. And what they found out is that the Republicans are so far off the deep end, they're not even listening sometimes to the business community on some of these issues.
Right, and the business community is sitting on trillions of dollars that could
exactly.
Get the economy kick-started back into gear. Just in the last couple of minutes there, Mike Lux, it seems to me there are a couple of wild cards here, as much as we're discussing, how the election may work out between Romney and Obama. It seems to me that, one, Obama's fate may well be in Merkel's hand in Germany, because they still haven't got their hands around the euro. And if that tanks, that's going to ripple across here. And it's also conceivable that Netanyahu's going to do something crazy, and he's close to the Republicans. There's a real incendiary mix going on there in the Straits of Hormuz, where miscalculations could lead to war, and at the very minimum, the price of gas goes through the roof. As you know, Republicans have been skillful over the years, since the Republican Party is largely owned by big oil, that they've always lowered the price of gas at election time, mysteriously. But the reverse could happen in this election year.
Yeah, the world, the economy, and then of course, the Middle East. There are so many landmines out there, and if Obama can negotiate them, it will be a minor miracle. I would say this though, I think Democrats win in tough times. If they're the incumbent. The Democrats that have won over the last century have run or have won by running tough populist campaigns by going after big oil for manipulating gas prices, by going after the big banks for causing economic collapse. And I think that's what Obama is going to have to do. And if he does that, I think he can actually survive, even more economic problems. But that's the kind of campaign he has to run, is he has to take it straight to the American people and tell them, look, things are screwed up because these big companies that are manipulating things are out of control, and I'm going to fix that, and the Republicans aren't. And I think especially when the foil is Mitt Romney, I think he's got a chance at making that sale.
Well, Mike Lux, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I hope to revisit you. It's going to be a long, contentious, painful, and expensive year.
Yes, it sure will. It'll be a wild ride with lots and twists and turns. So thanks very much for having me on. I'd be glad to come on back on anytime.
Thanks a lot. Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995. He's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be, and has an article at the Huffington Post, So Much for a Quiet Monday Afternoon, and another at the Daily Kos, Why Elections Matter. We're going to take a brief station break and move back talking with Sarah Posner about her article, The GOP's Race to the Dark Ages.
Says he's got a big boat, but it's just a ferry boat that makes for a shore ride. Says he's got a fast boat, talk about high speed. Get your oars back in the water, kid. Says he's got a fast boat, but it's just a fast.
So there's a band in that track, and the father's fighting in a sack.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, who is a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, The Religion Blogs at The Washington Post, and The Guardian, and other publications. She has an article at Religion Dispatches, The GOP's Race to the Dark Ages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks, Ian.
And I just have to give a brief update here as the results come in from New Hampshire. Sarah, at this point, Romney's still holding 35%, Ron Paul second, 24%, Huntsman 17%, third, Newt Gingrich at 10%, Santorum at 9%, and Perry at 1%. So it looks pretty much like a blowout in terms of Romney winning. And it's interesting to know that the religious right candidates, between them, barely got 20%. With Perry at 1%. I mean, why is he going to South Carolina? Has he made some kind of private deal with Romney to be a spoiler?
You really wonder about that. I think he probably thinks it's his last chance to break out of, what did he get in Iowa, 3%, 5%? He announced his candidacy in South Carolina. South Carolina is very conservative, a large population of conservative evangelicals, unlike New Hampshire. But Romney is not completely lacking in support from evangelicals. He still gets, he draws some of his support from evangelicals. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to win both the Iowa and the New Hampshire caucuses. I mean, the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. I think that Perry, like you said, Perry's role is probably going to work to Romney's benefit, because if there are evangelicals who can't vote for Romney either because, you know, they have questions about his Mormonism or because they have questions about his former stance on issues that matter to them, you know, that vote is going to be split, and Romney will probably win, which is exactly what happened in 2008 when McCain won the South Carolina primary.
Well, but back then, of course, they had Mike Huckabee, who, but the vote was also split with other, just as it is now,
right,
on the religious right.
With him and
they didn't coalesce around Huckabee, and this time they're not. Now I believe the power brokers on the religious right are meeting down in Texas, scrambling to settle on a anti-Romney candidate.
Exactly, and I think there are a handful of them, an influential handful, but still a handful, who are in favor of Romney. But again, it's very much like in 2008 when they felt that Huckabee, despite his status as a preacher and seemingly one of them, they had a lot of questions about his conservative credentials. And it was only later that some of them expressed regret over not having coalesced around him so that they would have a candidate who at least had the evangelical credentials that John McCain didn't. And if I could just add, I think that this will produce a similar set of circumstances as it did in 2008, where the nominee will be under pressure to pick a running mate that will be satisfactory to the religious right.
So given, Sarah Posner, that the Republican Party is largely a Southern party now, they've inherited the Dixiecrats, although the New South is different from the Old South, one wonders whether there's still some vestiges of the anti-papist KKK dogma. As much as they hated Jews, they also were suspicious of Catholics. And it seems so odd that the two carrying the banner for the religious right are these two Catholic fundamentalists, Santorum and Gingrich.
Right. It is interesting because I think 4 or 5 months ago we thought that Rick Perry was going to be their guy, and all signs in August and September were pointing in that direction until he took the stage at the debates. But I think that by and large, while there still may be some vestiges of anti-Catholic bias, I think that's largely a thing of the past. I think on the religious right, they have long cultivated what Francis Schaeffer called relationships with co-belligerents, right? So they would make common cause with Catholics because they share a similar set of beliefs or a nearly identical set of beliefs on some of these core issues like gay marriage, abortion, funding for Planned Parenthood, this whole like laundry list of what are commonly referred to as social issues. So I think that the Catholicism itself is not an issue. I think that the stumbling blocks with those two candidates are whether they're electable, whether conservatives have questions about them not being sufficiently conservative on issues like, you know, government spending and the role of government and the fact that those two, Gingrich and Santorum, spent time on K Street. You know, so there's another set of suspicions about them, but I don't think it has to do with their Catholicism.
Well, at least the Catholics are consistent theologically in their pro-life position, because they're also against capital punishment and against wars.
Well, that's true of the Catholic hierarchy, but it's not true of these Catholic candidates.
No, or perhaps the voters as well. I know that they've made common cause with the Christian Protestant fundamentalists in the South over abortion, but they're not exactly in sync theologically. But I've never thought, for example, Sarah Posner, that most of what passes for religion in this country, particularly that which you see on television. It's hard to find the religious component. It always seems to me to have been and is a front for right-wing politics.
Well, I think that the way that the religious right has politicized religion and turned it into a way of basically attempting to marginalize their political opponents, attempting to make their political opponents seem not patriotic or not in sync with true American values, not real Christians. You know, that's the picture that they've tried to paint of President Obama, because he does not subscribe to the same form of Christianity that they do, and they've even gone so far as to question whether he is a Christian. So, yeah, it's been used as, you know, a hammer rather than any, you know, more than anything else.
Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. She has an article at Religion Dispatches, The GOP's Race to the Dark Ages. And that's largely the article that I just referred to, is in many ways about Santorum and about what he thinks of Griswold versus Connecticut. And it seems to me in that debate that ABC had over the weekend, the moderators seemed to miss a huge opportunity. Stephanopoulos managed to irritate the audience, didn't lay a glove on Romney, who completely did not answer the question and took it in a different direction, almost ridiculing the seriousness of it. And nobody brought up the fact that Romney is far more vulnerable on his support for personhood, which is far more pernicious, isn't it, than the idea of, I mean, to some extent, I suppose you could argue that Romney's right that no states are about to ban contraception. The fact that a presidential candidate is back in the dark ages supporting that concept is something to gasp at. But just walk us through your critique of that, if you will.
Well, yeah, like you said, all of these candidates except for Huntsman and Ron Paul, who signed it with a caveat, signed the Personhood USA pledge. And the personhood bills and ballot measures that are cropping up in states all over the country, and which was defeated in Mississippi this just past election in November, would, because of their language, their very broad language of when life begins, and would effectively ban certain forms of birth control and, incidentally, certain forms of fertility treatments. So by signing the personhood pledge and basically putting your stamp of approval on that and promising to try to enact such a thing at the federal level if you became president, you're effectively saying, I'm in favor of outlawing certain forms of birth control as, you know, murder. So the fact that they were asked about the Griswold decision but weren't asked about that was a serious shortcoming by the moderators in that debate. But the whole reason it came up was on the campaign trail earlier in the week, Santorum had discussed Griswold versus Connecticut, which is this 1965 Supreme Court case, which invalidated state criminal bans on the sale or use of contraception, or the sale or promotion of the use of contraception. And he employed a very familiar argument on the right that Griswold created the privacy right that led to the decision in Roe and to the decision in Lawrence versus Texas, which is the Supreme Court case that invalidated the criminalization of sodomy, these anti-sodomy laws that used to be on the books. So while he's saying, well, I just disagree with this legal concept, the concept of creating this privacy right, by saying that you would be in favor of the overturning of Griswold, you're essentially saying, well, you know, if they overturn Griswold, then so, you know, whatever happens at the state level, if there's a state that decides to ban contraception, so be it. And that's the effect of saying that you think that Griswold was wrongly decided and should be overruled. Now, as a practical matter, are there going to be laws passed that ban contraception like the one that was invalidated in Griswold? I have a hard time imagining that, just because the majority of Catholics and evangelicals use contraception at some point in their lives. But just the idea that that Santorum doesn't think that Griswold is the sort of Supreme Court decision that did some good for our society and is in line with the Constitution speaks volumes about how he views the state's role in regulating people's sex lives.
Well, I suppose the good news in this context is that Santorum is coming in fifth in New Hampshire,
right,
with Romney at 20% reporting. Romney's now at 35.4. Ron Paul's at 24.7. Huntsman's at 17. Newt Gingrich's at 10.3. Santorum's at 10.1, and Perry's at 1%. And already. Romney's doing a victory lap, making a speech, talking about how America has to be strong and strong enough to the rest of the world to intimidate the rest of the world. That old Roman dictum: you don't want them to love us; you want them to fear us. I thought we'd gotten over that in the Bush era. He and Huntsman said he's going to continue the race. So what do you think is going to happen down in South Carolina? Is Romney going to just ride in on the crest of these two victories?
I think that I think Romney is going to be the nominee. And I think along the way, the Republicans who think he's either not conservative enough or not a genuine conservative are going to do everything they can, even if they can't stop him from getting the nomination, to yank him further to the right on all of these issues. Because think about it. Mitt Romney went from being someone who said that they thought that Roe versus Wade was correctly decided and that they would defend a woman's right to choose, to signing the personhood pledge. Okay? So when you think about that, that this has been the trajectory of his career because this is what he needs to do and say to get the Republican nomination, you can see already the effect that the more conservative wing of his party has had on him. So he may ultimately be the nominee, but their thumbprints are going to be on him.
Well, he's already said in that the ABC debate that he's for overturning Roe v. Wade and kicking it back to the states, which we'll live in an America where you will have young women in red states going to Greyhound bus depots to leave the state to go to a blue state to get an abortion. And then there'll be these Christian vigilantes at the Greyhound bus station checking their papers. I mean, this is a nightmare.
Yep. Well, you know, Roe versus Wade has not been overturned yet.
That's true. I mean, I'm being a little apocalyptic here, but the implications for what he's talking about are pretty grim.
Well, there are already states that have trigger laws which would automatically criminalize abortion, you know, without any further action by the legislature if Roe versus Wade were overturned. But the other thing to keep in mind, even while Roe is the law of the land, that there were a record number of restrictions on access to abortion passed in state legislatures last year. So this, what anti-choice activists call incrementalist approach, is working pretty well for them in terms of making it more difficult to get an abortion and to, you know, force Planned Parenthood clinics to close. So, you know, in many states, not only are there legal restrictions on getting an abortion, there are practical obstacles in the way because there aren't that many places where you can actually get an abortion. So,
well, just in closing, Sarah Posner, do you think that given how craven Romney has been in jettisoning all of his apparent moderate views in order to get the nomination, he's moved as far to the right as anybody in this race. Will he have to stay there? I mean, is he essentially set in stone in terms of the new Romney, the new Christian right Romney?
Well, I think he's got to be. I mean, how does he walk back from signing the personhood pledge?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, you know, he signed it. He thinks Roe versus Wade should be overturned. You know, he has said these things. So it seems difficult to believe that he'll that he could plausibly walk away from those.
Well, then it's up to Obama to speak for the majority of Americans who don't want to go back to the dark ages.
Let's hope.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Sarah Posner.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. She has an article at Religion Dispatches, The GOP's Race to the Dark Ages. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the possibility of a number of wars breaking out at strategic choke points around the world, in a concept that has been referred to as conflicts in the geo-energy age.
Some side with the leaves, some side with the seeds. But you and I will be undefeated by agreeing. No one wins but the thieves.
Don't melt the road to a tiny city's made of ashes. I'm gonna hit you on your face. I'm gonna punch you in your glasses. I'll make myself a teacher. Says the world is my ashtray. Our hearts burn dust and our hair's all gray. And I just got a message that says, yeah, hell has frozen over. I got a phone call from the Lord.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and the forthcoming book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he's just written a piece at Tom Dispatch, Danger Waters, The Three Top Hotspots of Potential Conflict in the Geo-Energy Era. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Ian, I'm pleased to be with you tonight.
And since we're ending this new epoch, the geo-energy era, explain that concept, if you will, Michael.
Well, this follows from a view that the world's energy supplies are dwindling relative to demand, and they are increasingly located distant from markets because we've used up all of the easily accessible sources of supply near at hand. You have to go further and further afield. So energy has to travel longer and longer distances by boat or by pipeline, and very often these supplies travel through very dangerous areas, areas of instability or piracy or conflict, and therefore they are at risk. So more and more of the world's military powers are going to be focused on protecting these long, attenuated supply lines that are so vital to our economy. I think that's the basis of the new defense policy of the Obama administration and also of the Chinese.
Well, we already see now that where we could be blundering into a war in the Gulf, another war in the Gulf over the Straits of Hormuz, with naval exercises that Iran are going to be conducting next month, along with a joint U.S.-Israeli exercise. You have the Israeli prime minister, who is very close to the Republican leadership. He may just attack. In fact, many analysts believe he will attack Iran this year. Whether the U.S. goes along with it or not, it would put Obama in an untenable position. And furthermore, of course, at the very least, the price of energy would go up. So, you know, just one little incident in the Straits of Hormuz at this energy choke point sets off, a bloody encounter, boosts oil prices, and puts the global economy at risk. What could be worse?
Yeah, I think you described it well. Now, I think that at this point, a lot of what is going on is bluff and bluster for domestic consumption. I think the Iranians' leadership, because of the economic hardships that they brought on their own people, are trying to whip up nationalistic sentiment by talking tough against the U.S. The Americans have to behave in the same way. Obama faces the Republican hardliners who are ready to go to war at a drop of a hat, so they have to talk tough. The Israelis have to talk tough. So a lot of this is for domestic political consumption. However, in that atmosphere, as you say, Ian, a very small incident could get out of hand, could trigger a major explosion. So it's a very dangerous situation.
And Michael Clare, again, the Five College Professor in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, and he has an article at Tom Dispatch, Danger Waters, the Three Top Hotspots of Potential Conflict in the Geoenergy Era. The other two hotspots, of course, are the South China Seas and the Caspian Sea Basin. Already, of course, not the other choke point for oil going to the east, that's to the Chinese, the growing Chinese market along with the Japanese and Korean market, is the Straits of Malacca next to Singapore there, where they have a problem with piracy, not so much anybody threatening to close the straits. Now, the Chinese have already, they're developing a pipeline from Burma, Myanmar, directly through to China to ease that choke point.
This is certainly true, but the fact remains that China's whole economy rests on its ability to import raw materials from Africa, from the rest of the world, the Middle East, and most of that is going to continue to go through the Strait of Malacca and the South China Sea. The same is true of Japan. They need to have unrestricted access to those waters, and they also, of course, export their products. So their whole economy depends on the safety of seaborne trade. And what the Obama administration is now saying is that the U.S. Navy is going to be the dominant power along these sea lanes. This is how we're going to exercise our power now. We're not going to be a land power in Asia as we were in the Bush administration in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we are going to control the sea lanes and control the economy of China, or potentially threaten the economy of China. And this, I fear, is going to create great anxiety in China and lead to a military response by the Chinese. So it's going to create a very dangerous situation.
So moving from the what the Navy calls SLOCs, sea lanes of communications, these choke points, The area of contention is around the uninhabited island chains of the Paracels and the Spratlys, which are claimed by Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines, all of whom have got together to negotiate with the Chinese, who, of course, have the dominant claim. Now, of course, into that mix, you have the fact that there has been oil and gas discovered. So explain that particular flashpoint to us.
Well, this is probably the most dangerous area in the world today, in my view, at least so far as the potential for a clash between the U.S. and China, because China claims the entire area of the South China Sea is part of its national territory, and that, therefore, they have control over shipments of ships through that area and the development of resources. But other countries, like you say, Ian, the Philippines and so on, also claim that area, and some of those countries are allied to the United States, have a defense treaty with the United States, and the U.S. says that this is international waters, doesn't belong to anybody, and that the U.S. believes in freedom of navigation through that area. So there is a potential clash between the Chinese view that this is Chinese territory and American view that this is open territory. And you could have a naval incident occurring there. And there have been. You'll recall that the American anti-submarine warfare ship, the Impeccable, was surrounded by Chinese ships a year or so ago and almost led to an incident. This is what I worry about, that an incident will blow up and lead to something more dangerous.
Well, let's go to the third geoenergy hotspot in the geoenergy era, and that is the Caspian Sea, where you've got a former Soviet republics, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, converging with Russia. I recently talked to somebody in Kazakhstan over the riots that were happening with the oil workers. It turned out that that was at a Chinese oil field that they were being mistreated. I know Chevron has been in there from the beginning. They developed the Tengiz oil field. There is enormous energy potential in this area. BP estimates that the Caspian Sea area has as much as 48 billion barrels of oil, mostly in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, and 450 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, mostly in Turkmenistan. So how do you rate this hotspot?
Well, this is probably the most interesting place from a geopolitical point of view, because you have not only China interested in extracting all of this energy, you have the European Union and the United States wants to get its hands on it, but then you have Russia, which once controlled the entire area when this was part of the Soviet Union and is very reluctant to see those countries become independent, and now is trying to regain control over the stands, as they're called, Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, what did I leave out, Uzbekistan. The Russians are trying to restore Moscow control over the flow of this energy so that they get all the benefit. So you have a three-way, four-way competition, and all of these countries are supplying arms and military aid to the various parties involved. So this could also potentially be a site of international conflict down the road.
Well, there's no question that that area it has always been was a Soviet. There were Soviet republics, and Russia would like to get them back. Stalin, of course, booby-trapped the whole system with, and all the pipelines go all the way through Russia. That's what the Chechen War was largely about. They don't want the only people that are independent. Territorially independent of Russian influence, the extracting this oil are the Georgians, and they've already had a war with Russia. So the writing's already on the wall about what Russia's intentions are. In fact, Putin's his college PhD thesis was on how to maintain economic and political power via oil pipelines. So we know where he's coming from.
Yeah, you're quite right. But now you have China as a player, and that's a new party to this competition. And the Chinese are very interested. As you said earlier, they've bought up oil fields in Kazakhstan. They're buying up natural gas from Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. They're also moving in military and other forms of geopolitical influence. Sometimes they cooperate with the Russians. They cooperate with the Russians in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a regional security organization, to try to drive out the Americans. But the Chinese and the Russians are in competitive form when it comes to extracting the oil and natural gas. They don't have the same interest. So you have a triangular relationship, and there's nothing else like this that I can think of.
Well, if sometime this year there's a war in the Gulf, and the first flashpoint that's really heating up, the Straits of Hormuz, that shuts off 20% of the flow of oil to the world, causes a global recession. Of course, Russia will be very happy to see that happen, although their oil fields have been so depleted, and the investment hasn't been adequate. They really don't have the ability that the Saudis have to export extra stuff. I'm afraid we've run out of time here. I thank you so much for joining us, Michael Clare.
It's good discussion. Always great to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. He has an article at Tom Dispatch, Danger Waters, the Three Top Hotspots of Potential Conflict in the Geo energy era. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with somebody that served in the Clinton White House, who heads up the Democratic Progressive Organization. We were speaking as the New Hampshire primary results came in. Obviously, it's going to be a Romney-Obama race. And how's Obama going to do against somebody who's such a representative of the 1%, such a corporate man as Romney? And unfortunately, of course, Obama's been so nice to the 1% and the corporations that the question is he really going to run a populist campaign? And Mike Luck seemed to think that getting rid of Daley as a chief of staff was a first step in a belated recognition that a lot of the 99% of Americans aren't too happy with how much the millionaires and the billionaires are getting away with everything. So it was an interesting discussion, although it just feels in many ways that the White House response is too little too late, and they've got an awful lot of catching up to do. And then we spoke with Sarah Posner, the senior editor of Religion Dispatches, about her article on Rick Santorum, the GOP's race to the Dark Ages. And she talked about how, obviously, the religious right are flaying about trying to find a candidate, a non-Romney candidate, but it's too late. They did the same thing in 2008. Apparently, they didn't get behind Huckabee and then ended up with McCain. But there's obviously a very pragmatic streak in the Republican Party, given the success of Romney. But she was particularly disturbed by Santorum's notion of banning contraception. But more importantly, she felt that the ABC debate of the Republican candidates really missed the point. The moderators should have gone after Romney on the question of personhood. He signed the personhood pledge, and that's a direct way to undo Roe v. Wade. In many ways, even more insane than Santorum's banning of contraceptions. Again, it comes down to Obama. Is he going to fight for women's rights? Because clearly, Romney's and these other Santorum and company are all on the wrong side of history, and also in the minority. And then finally, I spoke with Michael Clare about his new article about Danger Ward as the three top hotspots of potential conflict in the geoenergy age. Already, the Straits of Hormuz, like they're going to explode at any moment. Then the South China Sea is another one, and the Caspian Sea is another one. Very interesting discussion, and I'll certainly do a follow-up on it. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.